Welcome to this regular Friday meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our guest speaker today, while renowned as a singer and a musician, has devoted much of her adult life to the philosophy of nonviolent activism. A confirmed pacifist reared in a Quaker home, she was prominent in the anti-war and civil rights movements of the 1960s. And during that decade, she co-founded the Institute for the Study of Nonviolence. She is currently president of Humanitas International Human Rights Committee, an organization she established in 1979. The staff and members of Humanitas are, in our speaker's words, nonviolent in belief, nature, and practice, and are fighting for the basic rights of individuals regardless of ideology, for the rights to life, justice, religious belief, and free expression, for the right to refuse to kill. Over the past 5 years, our speaker has undertaken fact-finding missions to a number of foreign areas, including Vietnam, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Hong Kong. After a trip to Southeast Asia in 1979, she launched a campaign in cooperation with the San Francisco Examiner and KRON-TV to raise $1 million in emergency relief aid for destitute Vietnamese and Cambodians. That campaign reached its goal in less than 2 months. In June of this year, she traveled on a 5-week, 6-nation tour of Latin America to view firsthand the human rights situation throughout that region and to show support for the growing movement of nonviolent activism in Latin America. Upon returning, she summed up her trip with, "Repression is alive and thriving in Latin America." Please join me in welcoming our guest speaker today, whose topic is entitled Human Rights in the 80s, Seen Through Both Eyes, Joan Baez.
Thank you, Judith. Thanks very much. I'm really very, very pleased to be here, and I want to thank you for having invited me and thank those of you who are attending. You don't look so conservative. I don't usually read my speeches, but what I discovered was that there are a lot of things I want to say, and I know that I'll skip too many of them if I leave my notes for too long, so I will use some notes. I will speak to you as humanly, as directly, and as intelligently as I can, from my heart, from my brain, and from my personal experiences. I'm here as myself, as a nonviolent activist, as a president of a human rights organization, and as a member of what I like to refer to as the new moral necessity. Thank you. I'd like to tell you about how I and we at Humanitas perceive the colossal job of human survival which confronts the human race in the 1980s, about how we have tried to gain perspective of what things can be done for the betterment of humankind and some of the things that we at Humanitas have done. In the process, I hope, of course, to remind people, without being too obnoxious or too cumbersome, of certain moral necessities that must be taken seriously in the 1980s if we want to see something aside from the current near total breakdown, moral breakdown, taking place within nations and across national borders. The foundation for all of our activities comes from an idea which is certainly not new, but an idea to which there's enormous resistance wherever people have opinions and feelings in this world. This idea is a part of the new moral necessity. It is the idea of learning to see world problems through both eyes, not just the right or just the left, but seeing clearly and fairly through both eyes. It was really the importance of seeing through both eyes which gave Humanitas its beginnings in early 1979. I was conducting a study group in my home for the purpose of keeping up on world affairs. In February, our group was visited by two Vietnamese boat people, one a defrocked monk, the other a writer. Both had been against the U.S.-supported Tu regime. One had been jailed in the 60s for his beliefs and actions. By February of 1979, both had been so disillusioned by the new communist regime that they had followed in the historical flow of boat people into the South China Sea. They described to us the Vietnam they had left behind as a gulag of re-education camps, prisons, and forced labor, tremendous repression. Their question to me was, as a person who had shown such concern for the people of Vietnam during the U.S. involvement in that country, was I still concerned about the people of Vietnam? And were any of the others of the 60s who had been so outspoken on behalf of innocent victims of that war, were they still concerned? At that time, February 1979, Amnesty International claimed 200,000 political prisoners in Vietnam, and we began to investigate the situation ourselves. It became clearer and clearer that the question was not whether or not Vietnam had become a totalitarian state or why it had become one. It simply was one. The questions were, to myself and to my friends, could we face up to the fact that though we had tried for 10 years to liberate that tiny country, tried to bring self-determination and democracy to Vietnam, perhaps we had failed? I must say that I do not for a second regret my activities during those 10 years, that I think during the Vietnam War, the only civilized way to behave was to deny that that war should exist, and that's what we did. But I realized that 5 years after the withdrawal of American troops, Vietnam was being run by 17 aging Stalinists who were making life a hell for the majority of the population, and that the magnitude of the problem was huge, and that nobody I knew wanted to think about it, and that I was developing a case of visual preference which was excluding a priority problem, the very real pain and sorrow of the Vietnamese people in massive numbers. In fact, I discovered how widespread that eye disease was when I tried to recruit well-known activists of the 60s to sign an open letter to Hanoi decrying the status of their human rights. There were 81 signers. There could easily have been 500. What we risk by seeing fairly and justly through both eyes is our attachment to ideology. It's attachment to our country, to our party, to whatever clan in which we feel we've invested our identity, to whatever clan we hold an image of ourselves in, to whatever clan we've put our money in, and from whichever clan we derive what we call or feel to be a sense of security. I discovered once again through the project of the open letter how blessed I am to have never been burdened with an ideology. I've now been called both a pinko commie and a CIA rat, and a number of other things, I'm sure. I keep waiting for either of those groups to pay up. Neither ever does. And I consider the fact of those varying viewpoints and the outrage with which they are expressed to be a compliment to my sanity. My identity is as a member of the human race, certainly a flawed one like everybody else, but it's that, and no more and no less. I believe I'm capable of seeing through both eyes, and I'd like to tell you some of the things that I see before me in 1981. I see a world of such intense beauty that it's quite incomprehensible to me. I see races of enormously beautiful and handsome people walking the earth full of inborn pride. I see the magnificence of the human mind at work. I see the glory of art and of music. I see the winged victory carved in marble as smooth as soap. I see the human potential which literally takes us to the moon. Clearly, the rest of my speech today could be an accounting of the gifts, both man-made and of nature, which surround us daily. But then, of course, I see the dark forces of our weaknesses, our greed, and our myopia gaining momentum at a breakneck speed. I see starving children. I see 15 million refugees. I see pain and sorrow absolutely beyond our comprehension, from El Salvador and Guatemala, where torture and murder are institutionalized, to Sakharov's miserable exile in Gorky, from Vietnamese prison camps to the thousands of disappeared citizens in Argentina, from the dead Haitians on Florida's shores to South Africa's apartheid, from the daily executions in Iran to our own ghettos. All of these holocausts, from the immense to the moderate, emanate from the fact that power politics, whether right-wing or left-wing, that national interests coming from right-wing or left-wing governments, and that ideas and ideologies, right-wing or left-wing, are more important than the people they are supposed to serve. Perhaps this is becoming a trend, Also, there is no ideological safeguard from misery. Hunger is hunger, torture is torture, and dead is dead. I live in a country which I fear, at this point, is mixed up. I believe much of the population here prefers to be lulled to sleep. This makes me afraid. Lulled to sleep by reassuring advertisements on television, which give us a range of options, from the fastest acting headache pill to the reassurance that we have a government we can count on for a change. The Americans are known throughout the world, certainly in the places that I've ever traveled, for being a very, very warm people. We're also known for our apathy. I have an English friend who tells me, with all due respect, she says, that the Americans will never understand anything, my dear, until their central heating goes out. Which, of course, may not be that far away. The danger of this apathy is that it reinforces our sense of powerlessness. And when a general population feels powerless, it is willing to follow the dictates of whomever currently sits in power, no matter how visually impaired that leader might be. I criticize the apathy in this country partly out of a tremendous sense of waste. We have so much freedom to speak out, to act, to move, to care, and to really count in the international picture, in the greater scheme of things. Our privileges cry out to be made use of. I, for one, do not like the imposition of powerlessness put upon me, nor do I think it necessary for me or for anyone else, certainly in this room. An aversion to powerlessness became another reason for the existence of Humanitas in my life. We are now a small but determined staff, a nonviolent army, if you will, of 5 people, with representatives in 10 countries and a membership of 6,000 people. We hope to soon have a working office in Washington, D.C., and we have one already in London. We work to address the issues that we see as crucial in attempting to create a slightly more sane, slightly more humane world. We are dreamers, and we are no doubt fools, but we know our limitations. We aim high, we work like hell, and we feel a deep sense of satisfaction when somebody says to us, "You have made a difference in my life. Thank you." A brief history of things that we've done with Amnesty since the open letter to Vietnam. And some were mentioned, the Bay Area Cambodian Emergency Relief Fund, in which everybody in the Bay Area should really take a pride, because that $1.25 million was raised from junior high schools, elementary schools, benefit concerts, small donations, and those donations were very, very carefully looked after, taken to the border of Cambodia and Thailand by Humanitas executive director, and if the project did not already exist with which we were comfortable, she would create one. An example would be that CARE volunteered to go in with us to set up a program for feeding lactating mothers, pregnant mothers, and children under 5, and this way we felt we could keep ourselves as clean as possible in what was not a very clean situation. The CERF has gone on to do other refugee work, and Humanitas simply stretches our boundaries whenever we feel it necessary. If refugees are not traditional human rights, we will make them so for ourselves, or we will simply make them fit Humanitas. It was a need that we saw we wanted to have a part in filling, and so we did so. I'd like to mention that Humanitas is used partially as a vehicle to follow up on the actions of Joan Baez, the entertainer and public personality. We labored for 3 months over the subject of how to build an organization. Certainly, it should not be based around a personality such as myself. After we had wasted 3 months' time, during which we could have been involved in any other project, we agreed that my uniqueness should be used. In fact, since anyone in the public eye is bound to be used by any faction of people at any time, I prefer to have as much control as possible over how I'm used. I would like to be used by Humanitas for the betterment of humankind. Something like Martin Luther King saying, "If I'm going to be a drum major, let me be a drum major for justice. Let me be a drum major for peace." So Humanitas has built its own perimeters, stretching as far as we can as a nonprofit educational human rights organization. We've continued to raise money for Somalia, for East Timor. We began to see the necessity that what we felt, building a bridge between human rights and disarmament. Disarmament we looked upon as an issue absolutely included in human rights because the right to remain alive is the basic human right. And the largest threat to that human right at this point, in our opinion, is the arms race. We ran a consultation of human rights and disarmament in Madrid with Nobel Peace Prize winner Adolfo Pérez Esquivel from Argentina and Marid Corrigan, also Nobel Peace Prize winner from Ireland, and ex-Swedish ambassador to a number of places, Harold Edelson. The event was co-sponsored by International Fellowship of Reconciliation. We have begun that bridge. We have had policy consultations on disarmament at Stanford, where we've had speakers who are experts in the field of arms control. We've had expert pacifists, and we've had expert people who didn't believe a word we were saying. We tried to include them all in the evening. We've had policy consultations on Latin America, during which time I became very interested in trying to go to Latin America, also at the invitation of Pérez Esquivel. And so I attempted to have a concert tour. If the concert tour had come off commercially, half of that money would have gone to support the nonviolent groups that we were meeting and the human rights groups that we were affiliated with in Latin America. As some of you may know, I was prohibited from singing publicly in Argentina and Brazil, and Chile never gave me a work permit. So all three of the countries, promoters had originally expressed great interest in putting on my concerts. In fact, by the time we left on tour, Brazil had a lineup of 5 concerts in large venues. Argentina was still a strong possibility, and Chile had not yet issued a work permit, but we were innocent enough to think I might still get one. The other countries included on the tour, as we mentioned earlier, were Mexico, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. Argentina greeted me with no possibilities for a concert, no promoters available, no halls, tear gas lobbed into the meeting of Permanent Assembly on Human Rights at which I was speaking. On the second night, we were followed 24 hours a day by 2 cars filled with people who referred to themselves as my security, but who, when there was a bomb threat at my press conference, suggested that I go on ahead and they'd keep an eye out. I was kicked out of my hotel, and the bomb threats turned out to be quite real bombs. The beauty of what happened for me in Argentina was, of course, meeting the mothers of the disappeared people, young people, and the families of the detained. Probably there is no stronger group of people I've met anywhere on the face of the earth than these mothers. And for what we should know, those of us here who are parents, is what absolute torture it must be for a parent to go to bed every night, say, for most of the kidnappings took place between 5 and 7 years ago in Argentina, wondering whether your child is alive or dead, whether your child was violated, whether your child was beaten, raped, before they were killed, and most of them does not look very rosy that they will return. The women go silently and in a very dignified way every Thursday to the center of town, and they march, and they're requesting of the government only one thing, a list of where the children are, which of course presents an enormous problem for the government, but this is their request. And they say that they will do that forever, and they probably will. In Chile, they were much craftier with me. They did not prohibit me from singing an underground concert at which 5,000 people showed up. The sadness for me in Chile was that the entertainers with whom I shared an evening were terribly brave and beautiful musicians and magnificent people, and they were all scared because they were afraid that if repression tightened again in Chile, that they would be vulnerable. They would be put on the spot simply because of the evening spent together as entertainers and with Joan Baez, etc. But they are so brave. I mean, we really have no idea. And I think what I tasted in the 3 countries was some kind of idea of what it would be like to really be censored, that I couldn't go out and do what I do best, what's God's gift to me is my voice. I wouldn't be allowed to go out and sing my songs to people, and I had the tiniest taste of that, although I knew that I would leave the country and I could come home and I would be able to sing. In Brazil, it was a little more dramatic and a little more shocking because Brazil somehow now has a picture of being much more liberalized and open and democratization, etc. And in Brazil, the police came to the door before one of these unofficial concerts and with a lot of hemming and hawing finally made it clear that if I tried to sing in public in Brazil, I'd be arrested. So I went to the microphone and explained to everybody what had happened, and everybody had a good laugh. I guess they're used to it. It was sad. In each case, there would be individuals who'd come up to me on the street, upper middle class mother or father or family, they say, we're very, very embarrassed at the behavior of our government. And I was saying, so am I, plus which I'd really like to sing. But in each country, I probably sang more than I would have on a regular concert tour. We went from churches to family groups to mothers have disappeared. And the routine was simply, in those countries, my gift to them, my gift to the families, was to sing and to let them weep. I'd bring out my guitar, they'd bring out their hankies, I would sing, and they would weep. And we actually joked about it, but that was all that I had to offer. And I think it's a part of their lives and an important part, and so I shared that with them. We went to Nicaragua and Venezuela before coming home. When we returned, I did a number of talk shows, radio, newspapers, etc., talking about what had happened in Latin America, questioning who the Americans choose as their friends and why. We went to Washington because we felt we owed it to the mothers left behind in Argentina to go everywhere that we could. And in Washington, to our dismay, we discovered that human rights is in even worse shape as far as national priorities go than we had imagined. One State Department comment was to a congressman, if you want human rights program, you're going to have to make it each time you want it. And a high-ranking member of the State Department with whom Jeannie Murphy and I met, who deals specifically with Latin America, told us that he didn't feel El Salvadoran refugees should be given any temporary asylum here because he didn't feel that El Salvador was a particularly unsafe place to live. Well, we kind of staggered out of that meeting wondering really where to begin, and was there a death of human rights in Washington or what? It is my opinion that the very basic moral fiber of this country, if it's to exist at all, is dependent upon our treatment of people in need. Our willingness as the wealthiest and most powerful nation on earth to share with people who have nothing, to feel and express compassion. Compassion and caring are a part of the new moral necessity. They may save us from international disgrace. Speaking of compassion and caring, my last subject and the subject of current great interest to Humanitas is the nuclear freeze. We want desperately to find a way to express that we see the threat of nuclear holocaust as imminent, that we see it through both eyes. We feel that by introducing the freeze as a way of decelerating the arms race, we may make it clear that we see the threat as bilateral or multilateral. The fact is that the real threat to human life is probably not coming from either camp, so much as it exists 24 hours a day in the form of a possible accident. Although I must say that I find I'm absolutely terrified by the current rhetoric in the U.S. administration, I feel we must not continue the path of such light consideration of Europe. We must somehow include Europe in our own backyard. How would we feel if a major power stronger than ourselves toyed with the idea of a small nuclear explosion in Fresno Valley just to show some other major power also stronger than us that they must be taken seriously? Perhaps here we have come full circle. We're discussing $1 million a minute spent on armaments worldwide, and we are discussing underdeveloped countries and hunger, refugees, and the general imbalance of everything. I believe that by opening both eyes, we have half a chance at getting things in perspective, if not in focus. I believe that compassion and caring are wonderful things that can enrich our lives. Harald Edelstam was a Swedish ambassador to Chile during the coup. He was known for various acts of bravery. And one night when the Mexican embassy was being fired upon by oncoming tanks, and the Mexicans were firing out of the windows with their rather useless rifles, Harald Edelstam took the Swedish flag in his hand and walked in front of the tanks and between the bullets and got the Mexicans out of the Mexican embassy, took them to the Swedish embassy, and eventually got them out of the country. When I asked him, through very teary eyes, what made him do that, he said very simply, I cannot tolerate injustice. I like to think that none of us, if we see that injustice clearly, can tolerate it. I like to think that all of us have compassion and have caring and would like to see that enrich all of our lives. And I welcome you to join in any of our activities or surely any activity that you see is needed. And I thank you very, very much for being here today.
Thank you, Joan Baez. We will now turn the meeting over to the president of the Commonwealth Club of California, Mr. Eugene Herson, who will preside over the question and answer period.
Thank you, Judy. Joan, if you'd return to the podium, we have a large array of questions. The first may prove the most difficult. Now that you're over 40 and shed the folk singer image, do you think people are taking you seriously?
I hope so.
Please comment on the Reagan administration's attitudes on the human rights issues.
Where are they? No, but more seriously, very, very deeply concerned over something like Jean Kirkpatrick's trip to Latin America, really praising terribly oppressive dictatorships which torture people still. I think we have to look carefully at who our friends are and take a part in choosing them.
What is the stance of your organization regarding the human rights of the millions of illegal aliens in our country?
I think that it would be helpful for all of us to refer to illegal aliens as human beings, and then we get some kind of perspective on what their lives are like, why they're here, and how we might be able to cope with the problem, thinking of them as people rather than illegal aliens. And again, to remind all of us that we have so much. We really have so much here. We do not, most of us, understand poverty or even poorness or even lack of just about anything. This doesn't go, of course, for people in a ghetto. But even people in a ghetto in this country have not had Cambodian starvation, Ugandan starvation. We really have to see what it is we have to share and go about sharing it.
On the difficult issue of refugees, should there be limits to the number of refugees from repressive regimes that should be admitted into the U.S.?
I think that probably the real answer to that is, of course, the most difficult one. How do you get people to not want to be leaving their homes? And I think, again, if we look very carefully, we must see in some of the situations what part we have taken in driving some people out of their countries. In Vietnam, obviously, it has nothing to do with our fault at this point. That could be argued, I'm sure, because of what we, in fact, did to Vietnam. But see what it is. How can we share with countries? I always think of a beautiful book called Lest Innocent Blood Be Shed. It was a town in France where the community was nonviolent. I don't know why, some weird quirk of nature. They simply were, and they accepted every single Jew who came through that town. They fed, clothed, and hid, and helped escape at risk to their own lives, and they were arrested, and they were oftentimes tortured, and some were killed. But when somebody said to them, why did you do all these magnificent acts? They didn't even understand the question. It was simply what you do. Somebody's hungry, you feed them. And somebody's feet are bare, you find some shoes for them.
A personal question. You work so hard for good causes. Do you ever get tired and think about giving up?
I get tired.
There's an array of questions on the human rights issue in every country in the globe, I think, here, so we'll just see what we can hit. The first, now that you see what has happened in Vietnam, how do you feel about America's role in the war?
Same as I ever did. I don't think that we improved the situation in Vietnam. I think, in a sense, what we did was help create the fifth or sixth largest army in the world. Without the outside invasions that that country had for years and years, either you start with China and go back 1,000 years, or you start with the French and the Japanese and go back 35 years, and then the Americans. But I think to constantly be bombarding them, they developed such a mentality of militarism that it was really impossible to think any other way. Somebody told me a very curious thing about the Vietnamese about a year after the withdrawal of American troops and the actual bombardment having stopped. They were developing neuroses. They'd never had them before. They didn't have time for it. They had been so busy simply trying to protect themselves, and I think that built such a mentality of militarism that it was really impossible to start with any kind of general peace plan.
On South Africa, should apartheid in South Africa be terminated, even if it means that this vital source of minerals critical to our nation's survival could become Marxist-dominated?
You just watch us buy from those old Marxists when we have to.
Do human rights groups tend to avoid criticism of violations in the Soviet Union?
Depends on the human rights group. It really does, and that's why we've built ourselves the way we have. We don't want to avoid criticizing human rights violations anywhere, but certainly there are leftist human rights groups and rightist human rights groups, and I'm sure they have done some good. I think it makes a lot more sense to see through both eyes because you have some credibility for yourselves.
Overall, is the human rights situation in the black African countries better or worse since their independence?
I think that in some cases it has been ghastly since, and I don't feel qualified enough to really answer that question fully.
How about this one? Can you briefly describe the difference in viewpoints between you and Jane Fonda?
Yes, Jane Fonda is a leftist, basically, certainly in the things that I've seen her do. I admire her very much for the fact that she got out and did, which is very rare in the entertainment field. She did not share with me a willingness to criticize the Hanoi government, and I felt that was a serious case of myopia of one eye.
Here's a chance for an advertisement. What unique niche in the human rights battle does Humanist International fill?
We work fast, and we're imaginative, and we would like you all to join up. And if you want to write to us, we're Humanitas, Box 818, in Menlo Park, California.
Your past is symbolized by Where Have All the Flowers Gone? Is your future embodied in diamonds and rust?
Hold the rust.
In your view, is ERA necessary to assure that U.S. women have rights equal to or even greater than men?
Yes.
I told her to make her answer short, but I'm running out of questions. Is the UN part of the problem or part of the solution?
I certainly wish the UN could be genuinely part of the solution, but the size of it and the red tape each time we have become involved is frightening. And yet, I'm glad they're there, and we will still continue to work with them and use them to whichever degree that we can, whenever possible.
What is the impact of the world's major religions on improvements of human rights?
Boy, that's scary, because that can go either way, such as Iran, or such as, in my opinion, the church in this country, being probably the most active and meaningful force in having anything to do with change for the better in Latin America, that probably in coordination with the Latin American Catholic churches and other churches, the issues of human rights violations, of torture and repression in Latin America have come to life in a way that they could not have come to life in this country without the church. That's my feeling. So I'm sure that it goes both ways. A holy wars scare me to death.
On the issue of the draft, do you favor registration and military draft when the forces necessary to defend this country would not be available through the voluntary enlistment system?
That's a rough one because it takes about 17 hours to answer and a long discussion. If I felt that the armies were really making us safer, I would have a big struggle with that question. I don't think, my feeling is that the ethical is also the practical, and that becomes less mumbo-jumbo in the 1980s than it's ever been before, probably for practical reasons. But an army is really in existence for one reason, and that's to fight. And it's getting more and more dangerous to have fights in this decade and in this century. On top of that, I think young people lose total sense of control of their own lives when they're subjected to the draft. And yet, eliminating the draft, as we've seen once before, and in a project in which I was very heavily involved in the 60s, does not end the military. Ideally, for me, I would like to see a world with no nations, and I'd like to see a world with no military. Now, I'm bright enough to know that's dreaming, thank God. But I think that the exclusivity of nations works against us. It works against the possibility of living with each other, of caring about each other, of seeing the world as one backyard. People are constantly saying, take care of your own backyard, clean up your own backyard first. There's only one backyard left. Either it's because the world has shrunk the way it has shrunk, or because all of these countries are available to us, either through communications or through bombs. But there is really only one backyard, and somehow, again, a fresh mentality about how to think of preserving that backyard needs to be faced up to by all of us.
On the youth of the 60s, this member asked, have most of the brilliant and active youth of the 1960s re-entered the mainstream of our society, or have they remained as a lost generation?
That doesn't give much hope, does it? Person who'd like to raise your hand, whoever wrote that question. I think all of us go in and out of the mainstream. I know I do. I'm not willing to condemn anybody for that, nor am I willing to condemn anybody for being part of a lost generation. I think any young person could look at any one page of any newspaper in this country and give up completely after having read one page and become a member of a lost generation. And my heart goes out to them. But I'd like to recruit them. I'd like to recruit them for something better, because I think their energy is there and they're just scared. You cannot blame anybody for being scared. You really cannot blame anybody for giving up. We just have to be creative and imaginative enough to be able to recruit people to do something better than give up, to do something better than be part of a drug culture and be part of a dropout generation.
Considering the breadth of your experience, in what countries are human rights more adequately protected than here in the United States?
Probably Scandinavia. I'd like to just say one thing I forgot to mention in the speech, which was there was kind of an honor to me to have been officially banned in three countries, and officially because we couldn't count Chile. Chile kept it unofficial. But it would be Argentina, Brazil, and USSR. They're really lousy on it. But I think what I'd like to say in general about who's better, who's best, if all of us could look at the fact that we happen to be Americans or Swedes or Africans or whatever we are, as an accident of our birth, rather than something over which to unfurl banners and play marches and build armies. Really, it was an accident that I was born an American. I consider myself very lucky for that. When I was on the Phil Donahue show, some woman in the middle of I don't know what, and unfortunately was not on camera, said in a kind of knee-jerk reaction to me, is there anything about this country that you do like, Miss Baez? And I said, yes, absolutely. Certainly, when Jeannie Triola Murphy and I returned from Latin America, we felt an acute awareness of and appreciation for our personal and political freedoms. We run a human rights organization here, and after we saw Adolfo Perez Esquivel, a Nobel Peace Prize winner, trying to run his office amidst bomb threats and these cars full of phony security people, we realized we have it easy. I mean, it really is a glorious place to work and a place to take advantage of. And at the same time, I said to this woman, it also made us acutely aware of our, quote, friends in Latin America. Why do we choose them when they are really the opposite of what everything we stand for, everything we say that we stand for? And with Nicaragua, why could we not have used brains with Nicaragua? Why could we not have made a Tito situation, even in Central America, where it was neutralized to the point that we didn't have to force them into a camp where they really didn't want to go? They don't want to go. And now I really think that it is too late. I mean, the foolishness of us saying we're not going to sell grain to Nicaragua, and so we sell it to USSR, Nicaragua buys it from USSR, and then we say, you see, they're in the Soviet camp. You know, I mean, we just got to use our noodles a little more, I think.
Joan told me over lunch, the tougher the question, the better, so here we go. Do you still believe that individuals have the right to withhold federal income taxes as a reaction to national policies and programs?
Sure. Now, I would rather see somebody stand up for whatever harebrained reason they even had, even if I didn't agree with them at all, stand up and do something. Take your position, make it clear, and follow it through. I think I've always felt that way. Listen, federal income tax is an imposition. What I like to do is tax myself, and that's what I've done all of my working life, as I've taxed myself probably somewhere between a quarter and three quarters of what I make has gone into the work that I do, has gone into people who need that money more than I need it. I don't need it. I live well. Don't let me try and kid anybody. I live very well as a California mom. But I'm happy and willing to tax myself. And I think we can do that, again, if we're willing to see things as they are and willing to make small sacrifices.
Now that the Vietnam War is over, this member asks, have your groups or others forgot the Vietnam vets? We'd like some attention, too.
No, we haven't forgotten the Vietnam vets. Humanitas has not made working with vets part of our program, but I generally do, personally, try to do whatever I can for whatever the program is. Certainly in the issue of Agent Orange, we've worked to try to bring that out as a real issue, which it is. And earlier this afternoon, I was very moved because I was approached by a young man who said that he was a pilot over Hanoi when I was trapped in Hanoi in Christmas of 1972. I was delivering mail to prisoners of war, American prisoners of war in Hanoi. And the young man said that he felt badly about the position he had had then. And when I was in the shelter there, I remember arguing about sanctity of life. And I was arguing with Marxist press people from the French press corps, and I was arguing with Vietnamese. And I refused to toast the fallen B-52s. There was a young, enthusiastic Vietnamese who, every time he heard a B-52 was being shot out of the sky, would run off and try to get some vodka to toast the situation, and I would leave the room. And the more adult of the Vietnamese in the group would shush him, in effect, say, listen, there's this woman in the room who doesn't approve of this kind of stuff. And when the French press finally said to me, in an absolute outrage, we'd been heavily bombed, and each time, you really do think that's it, that's the end of your life. And it's a very frightening thing. I consider it a gift to myself that I was there and that I lived through it, because it was something that gives me a little bit of extra vision, I think. But anyway, this French press corpsman said, aren't you happy? Don't you want to celebrate when you see that B-52 shot out of the sky? And I said, only if I know that the pilots are safe. And he was furious with me. He wanted to see them all go up in flames. But that really has been my entire meaning in life, is the sanctity of everybody's life. And that I think all the people, even if I disagree entirely with them, are salvageable, in my opinion, to doing what I think may eventually be the morally correct thing to do. And maybe I'm wrong. I don't think in that situation I was.
We have time but for one more question. Before I ask it, let me thank you, Joan Baez, President, Humanitas International, for your address on the topic, Human Rights in the 80s, Seeing Through Both Eyes. On behalf of the members of the Commonwealth Club of California, many of whom are gathered here in the Gold Ballroom of the Sheraton Palace Hotel in San Francisco, as well as those who hear your remarks rebroadcast over the club's radio network of more than 130 stations, and the more than 14,000 members of this organization who read a summary of your remarks in the weekly Commonwealth. After your response to the question, the meeting will stand adjourned. That question, shall we overcome?
Yes, with your help, with all of you. I think we shall overcome. I'm not an optimist, but I have hope, and I have hope because I believe in people. We may be crushed. I'm writing a song right now for an album which is called The Children of the 80s. And the children of the 80s are the young people who may be called a lost generation at this point. But there are young people who also call themselves the warriors of the sun. And they're young people who want to make social change. They're young people who care. And I'll just finish by giving you the first verse of that song. It says, we are the warriors of the sun, fighting post-war battles that somehow never got won. We may be crazy, this may be our final run, but we are the warriors of the sun. Thank you.